Today on The Nose, we went to see Creed 2, which is the latest in what you could sort of call the extended Rocky saga. We'll also talk about men doing bad things, which is something we seem to talk about a lot these days on The Nose. In this case, the late director Bertolucci did bad things. Did a critic lose his job for not quite emphasizing those bad things enough and making jokes about them? And lastly, you know, we can't go more than 3 or 4 weeks without a Louis C.K. conversation. This one's about a French woman who really seems to love him. And welcome to The Nose. It's the end of the week, but it's the beginning of The Nose. We've got a very exciting panel and a very exciting set of topics. Which should I talk about first? Well, today on The Nose, the death of the director Bernardo Bertolucci has triggered a whole series of other discussions, ranging from the lack of informed consent in the infamous butter scene in Last Tango in Paris, to whether or not a critic, much beloved of this show, should have been fired from another public radio show for a joke about said scene. We'll be talking about all of that. And, you know, basically, just in terms of a show like this one, every 2 months we have to have a conversation about Louis C.K. I don't really know why that is, but we do. Now there's a French woman who's in love with him. Their dairy practices, we don't want to know about. But anyway, all of that is to come. And then we've also been to the movies to see Creed 2, which is sort of the second installment in the kind of extended Rocky universe, maybe we could say. We'll be talking about that as well. Now, who will we be talking with? Teresa Kramer is a writer and the editor of E-Content Magazine and one of the earliest Neolithic members of The Nose, but that we don't have around that much anymore. Although, I guess you're around more now. That's good. That's a happy thing. Bill Usman is professor of media studies at Sacred Heart University. And James Hanley is co-founder of Cine Studio at Trinity College. We'd like you to know that Cine Studio is screening Christopher Nolan's Interstellar on 70mm film. A rare chance to see a masterpiece in that format. Assuming you think Interstellar is a masterpiece, people can debate that one. But it would be really fun tonight because Ron Mallett, who's a terrific guy, he's a UConn professor emeritus of physics, often discussed as a possible Spike Lee movie in the works because he is one of the physicists who feels as though he has a way of talking about the possibility of time travel. And Ron's great. He'll be a lot of fun. So if you're going to see Interstellar, go tonight. And you get the 70mm treatment, and you get Ron Mallett. Also, coming up on Thursday, I'm going to cut work for this because this does appeal to me. It's a great thing to do. National Theater Live there at Trinity Cine Studio at 2 p.m. Antony and Cleopatra with Sophie Okonedo and Rafe Fiennes. And there'll be an encore performance on Sunday. I guess I could do that one instead. That's December 9th at 1 p.m. So that's really fun. You get to see National Theater live on a great big huge screen. All right. So with that, I guess we're going to start with Bertolucci. So he died. So did a lot of other people this week. It's like a really bad week for people in the arts dying. Nicholas Roeg, also a fabulous director, died. Ricky Jay, the magician and card shark, died. The creator of SpongeBob died. It's a terrible week that way. But Bertolucci dies, and it kind of resurrects something that had been talked about a little bit already, which was this notorious scene in Last Tango in Paris. This is the scene where, how can I put it at all, actually, yeah. Where Maria Schneider, the character played by Maria Schneider, has an encounter not of her liking with the character played by Marlon Brando. Well, I mean, I don't know. Turn the radio down if there's kids in the car. So I don't know how else to say this, but he kind of initiates a not particularly welcome act of anal penetration assisted by butter from the refrigerator. I mean, there's no other way to talk about it. We just have to be grownups and say that. So James, this has become controversial because, in fact, as the years went by, Maria Schneider, who is now no longer with us, started talking about the fact that she just didn't see this coming.
Right. I think that, one of the things about this whole affair is that it goes to the heart of sort of creating a performance in a film that is believable and that is real, which I think Bertolucci, in many ways, that's one of his great skills in many of his films, things like 1900 and The Last Emperor, where there's a sort of reality created. And one of the things about Last Tango in Paris, it was transgressive in lots of ways. But in particular, I thought Maria Schneider, when I first saw that film, Maria Schneider herself seemed like a genuinely, really not particularly secure young woman. And I think that one of the things that makes me most uncomfortable about that scene really is that there's a feeling of her edge, that she's on edge, and she's actually, when she started talking about it later, was it confirmed that she was she was exploited, simple as that.
Right, and Bertolucci himself has kind of confirmed this later. Let's hear him. This is a clip that James steered us towards.
I think that she hated me and also Marlon because we didn't tell her that there was this that detail of the butter I use as a lubricant. I still feel very guilty for that.
Do you regret the fact that you have shot the scene like you did?
No, but I feel guilty. But I feel guilty, but I do not regret. You know, to make movies sometimes, to obtain something, I think that you have to be completely free. I didn't want Maria to act her humiliation, her rage. I wanted Maria to feel, not to act, the rage and the humiliation. Then she hated me for all life.
One thing that we should make clear is, as far as anybody knows, this was acted out. In other words, the actual physical act was not engaged in. Nonetheless, if it's kind of sprung on you by surprise. So, James, I interrupted you. Finish your thought, and I want to hear from everybody else, too.
Well, the thing that I'm immediately thinking about when I hear this, you know, how he's explaining it. He wants to have it both ways. You know, he wants to have the moral high ground, but he also wants to exploit. And exploit means that he's going to use Maria Schneider in this scene to get what he wants and to get the exact reaction he wants. But I would say, supposing it had been the other way around and it was Marlon Brando who was going to be presented with a little surprise, shall we say. And, you know, would he have said that? Would we be having this conversation? I mean, would that film have been made at that point?
I'm guessing Deliverance came out that year, that they gave Ned Beatty plenty of warning.
Yes, I was about to raise that, yeah.
But what was going on? We don't know that. No, it's never been discussed. Yeah, I mean, Teresa, he's raising a question that does come up in the arts a lot, although I feel like sometimes we say, well, it was a different time, a different place, they had different standards. I don't know. I don't think this, like, really washes ever what he's talking about.
No, I mean, what he's basically saying is I did it for my art, right? Like, it's okay to humiliate. And he's saying, I didn't want her to act. I wanted her to actually be humiliated and filled with rage. Yeah. And that's not okay for any reason, really. And he certainly, and James brings up the point, like, would he have done this to Marlon Brando? And last night I was talking about this with my boyfriend, and he found this story of Marlon Brando refusing to learn his lines even for the movie and just putting postcards around the room with them on them and actually asking at one point if he could just write his lines on Maria Schneider's rear end, which just, you know, speaks volumes about the kind of person he was and that she was just a prop for these guys in this movie.
Bill?
Yeah, I think it's really clear that there was a certain dynamic between Bertolucci and Brando that was their own kind of dynamic, and Schneider was really just a visitor in their world, and they were going to do whatever they thought was necessary, and she didn't have any voice in it whatsoever. I think it's important to put out there that Maria Schneider was a 19-year-old girl at the time that this happened. You know, again, yes, there was no actual rape on the set, but there certainly was the humiliation of a young woman. And to fall, I don't know what's worse, that they did it then or that Bertolucci more recently said that, oh, yes, it was a terrible, terrible thing, but I would do it again. And then just to fall back on art. Yes, I do believe that art pushes us and makes us test boundaries and go to dark places. But to just use that as an excuse of the utter humiliation of another human being, I really do think is simply an excuse, and there is no morality there that can be ascribed to, well, this is just what artists have to do.
I mean, James, there's like a whole history of directors subjecting actors to all kinds of stresses and strains, you know, often, you know, just sort of physical discomfort in order to get certain effects. And that probably will continue to go, like, go do this stunt, you know, like that. But, I mean, there's like – we're talking about a very different area here, right?
I think that it crosses a different line, yes, because I think that there's always, as you point out, there's always going to be the opportunity to do these kinds of things in the – setting of in theater as well, actually. But the point is that I think it is particularly bad where you're taking vulnerability and exploiting vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's inexperienced, perhaps, or in the film industry, it's usually men with young women, older men with young women. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you look at people like Pablo Picasso and his behavior, and you know, you're also
or Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren, right around the same time.
I was going to say that you can look at Marnie, for example, Hitchcock's Marnie, and I mean, I find myself squirming when I'm watching that. But Hitchcock was a sort of walking, talking compendium of dysfunction and exploitation. And yet he creates these films that have a reputation for grabbing you and sort of like being thrillers, but also funny and wry and strange. But the truth is that Hitchcock was a very kinky person, and he had a lot of money behind him, and he was successful at doing what he did. But you listen to Tippi Hedren talk about what happened to her, and you think that art isn't worth that. To be destroying somebody's sense of themselves in the service of art, and I think that I look at, you know, I mean, frankly, if I were to sit and watch Last Tango in Paris now, I think it just wouldn't be the same. At the time that when I first saw it, it was transgressive and it was something exciting in the development of cinema itself. And Bertolucci was an extraordinary filmmaker. But now I don't think I could watch it the same way anymore.
We have to shift gears a little bit right now. We're running out of time. Though I do want to say that, because this is never going to get on the air, I did an interview on stage recently with Richard Plepler, the head of HBO. One of the things we talked about is HBO now has hired permanently something called an intimacy coordinator. This started because of a show called The Deuce, which has a fair amount of sort of simulated porn and stuff like that going on in it. And so there's somebody on the set all the time for everything that they do that involves any kind of sex or nudity or anything like that. Whose job it is to make sure that lines don't get crossed, that people aren't placed in uncomfortable positions, that actors and actresses, probably particularly actresses, are not forced or coerced in any way into doing things they're not comfortable with. We're living in a different age now. It doesn't mean these bad things won't still happen, but there's more being done about this. Okay, so we do have to shift, and here I have to kind of declare a little bit of a conflict of interest. David Edelstein, the critic for Fresh Air, as well as CBS Sunday Morning, and New York Magazine, is a very, very old friend of mine and somebody who's been on the show a lot. He lost that Fresh Air gig this week because he tweeted out kind of a joke. So apropos of Bertolucci's death, a little bit of a joke about the butter scene. We can talk a little bit about what that joke was and what he tried to do in terms of apologizing or walk it back. But I don't know, Bill, I know that you've been following this pretty closely and discussing it with people on social media. Maybe we just start with your overall take on it.
Yeah, sure. I don't have any personal relationship with David Edelstein. I was one of his Facebook friends, one of 2,000, you know, odd Facebook friends. So I kind of saw this unfold in real time. I saw the original post. And when I saw the original post, I thought, wow, like this is just like stupid. It's not funny. It's in really, really bad taste.
Right. I said tweeted. It was Facebook.
Yeah. It's very crass. I was surprised by it. Mm-hmm. But then shortly after, I immediately saw that it was gone and that David Edelstein had posted a very, very sincere mea culpa. And I saw it as completely heartfelt in terms of, wow, like I really messed up here. I can't believe I did this. This is shaking me to my core. And, you know, he said I had forgotten about, you know, all of the stuff related to this. That, I think, is weird. Mm-hmm. I don't know how, you know, a film critic, a film historian wouldn't have been at the top of their mind. But it was a mistake. And I do think that in the wake of his apology and in the wake of it really just kind of being a momentary lapse of stupidity, that parting ways with him, as WHYY and Fresh Air have said, was a complete and total overreaction on their part. And there's a huge difference between the stupid joke that David Edelstein told and the actions of Brando and Bertolucci. And I don't think we should be conflating those as if they are all one and the same thing.
Yeah. I don't know. Teresa, what's your take here?
Well, unfortunately, my take is pretty similar to Bill's. my feeling – so part of the conversation around this is whether or not this is actually even a scene that depicts rape, right? Mm. Which I find to be a very strange conversation because I had not seen this movie before. I went and sought out the scene specifically because we were going to be talking about it. And she is crying and saying no. If you can't figure out that that's a rape scene, there's something – wrong. There's something right. very wrong and someone needs to send you to a sensitivity
file. Yeah, and I agree with that.
But even knowing full well that this is a rape scene and even if he'd known the history of what Maria Schneider felt and said about this in more recent years, it's still just a stupid joke. And I think we have to stop trying to take away people's jobs over dumb jokes because it breeds anger and resentment instead of using these moments to teach people. Like, I'd much rather hear Terry Gross have a conversation with Edelstein about yes. his experience yes. about this than fire him over it. And I think part of this is now sort of the second or third time he's gotten himself in trouble by saying or writing something kind of that people took poorly. And so maybe they're just like, we don't want to keep going through this, so we're going to part ways with you. But I'm just perturbed in general at the overall desire to take people's jobs away every time they mess up and to treat, as Bill said before, one sort of hashtag Me Too sin the same as every other one, right? Like, you know, what Louis C.K. did is not the same as what Bill Cosby did, and what Bill Cosby did is not the same as what Bertolucci and Brando did. But for some reason, everybody sort of, in the rare, except for in the Bill Cosby case where he actually gets prosecuted, everybody's suffering the same fate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
James, you have
I pretty much agree with that. I think it's kind of interestingly instructive about the sort of false intimacy of Facebook and online media generally. That I mean, it's a stupid joke, certainly. There is this weirdness about how David Edelstein's explanation about being a film person and not being aware of all the surroundings of this whole thing, because certainly as a film exhibitor, I've been aware of it for a long time, and it's been popping up over and over again with statements from Maria Schneider and also Bertolucci himself. But I think that somehow social media, if you're going to deal with people's behavior and possibly, you know, transgressive behavior, I agree it's over the top to be saying, you know, fire the person right away. But it's an illustration, really, of the dysfunction, I think, of social media where people, you get the feeling that maybe, you know, this was a certain time of night when this popped up or something, or he wasn't fully aware,
yeah.
or maybe whatever. And he puts down something that he might say to somebody in the room, but then he puts it out in the social media setting where it suddenly becomes currency. And I don't think he's the only one who does that. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who do that. And I think it can be carried away at that point. And then you have to start picking up the pieces. And we are in a very reactive universe about all of this at the moment. And I think for good reason, actually, because very real exploitation has taken place. But it is absolutely essential to have some sort of sense of proportion about what people say and what they do and what they actually have been involved with. I think that's absolutely crucial.
I should say that the posting was, and it was sort of by way of David commemorating his sadness about Bertolucci's death, but he did it with a joke, and he had a post that showed a picture from that scene, a still from that scene, and it said, "Even grief goes better with butter." And I just want to say a couple of things about this. I mean, I'm not a particularly trustworthy source of commentary about this because David and I are very old friends, and I would probably stick up for him almost no matter what. But I do feel as though, you know, I look at Fresh Air. Fresh Air, like, really, maybe more than any show on public radio, celebrates transgressive comedy. You can go on Amazon right now and buy some compilations of Terry Gross interviewing Don Rickles, you know, Richard Pryor, Sarah Silverman, Bill Maher. You know, these are like people she really likes a lot. She likes to talk about them. And these are people who what they do often is kind of test the limits. What can you say? What can't you say? If you're Sarah Silverman, maybe you can say this. Bill Maher probably couldn't say that. Bill Maher certainly tries to say words that only Richard Pryor could say. But all of that kind of gets shaken out in this process of discourse. And so, you know, and I'm not saying that like a dopey Facebook post is quite on the same level. But if you're going to like that kind of stuff but have a, you know, one strike and you're out rule for people who contribute to your show, I sort of wonder, you know, what's value set you're honoring here. I just, you know, it was a dumb thing to post, but boy, if I got fired every time, I mean, Bill's seen me post a joke in real time that I immediately had to take down because somebody didn't like it. And I thought, well, so I shouldn't, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if you could get fired for saying stupid things, I'd be living in Colin's spare room. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no question about that. I make a habit of doing that on a regular basis. And, well, apparently, I say, if you could. Well, apparently, under some circumstances, you can. To me, this was very much a PR move and sort of virtue signaling on the part of whoever it was, Fresh Air, WHYY. I think it opens up some interesting questions about who does make these decisions. Mm-hmm. Who was behind that decision? Was there a lawyer in the room? Was there some corporate executive in the room? And what really was the point of it, and why are they able to hold, in their mind, both ends of those ropes at the same time and promote transgressive comedians who aren't employed by them but then have these ridiculously tight limits on those who are employed by them? And how much of that is just a public relations strategy on their part that Edelstein got swept up in by being foolish?
Yeah, I just, you know, I think Teresa raises a great point. Matt Damon tried to raise this point early in the Me Too movement, and he got in trouble for that, saying there needs to be proportionality. You kind of have to look, you know, how badly did anybody get hurt? Did anybody get hurt? You know, I would sort of argue in the case of Edelstein, nobody really got hurt here at all. In the case of Maria Schneider, it is clear somebody got hurt. Somebody got hurt real bad. So I don't know. I mean, it's – well, actually, we have to do a little segue here from here to Louis C.K. because we always have to talk about Louis C.K. So it turns out that there is a French woman comedian who has not only defended Louis C.K. but now been seen holding hands with him, and like they might be an item or something like that. But I, you know, there's a way, James, in which – and so she's talked a little bit about this, and she and some other prominent French women have brought all of this stuff up in a very different way. Some might say a very French way, you know, that they don't necessarily want to be as strictly monitored, and they don't want men to be quite as strictly monitored or as severely punished for some of the things that for which punishment is being meted out right now. I guess the best way of living out those principles is to date Louis C.K.
I guess that's it. My feeling is that, well, I mean, for a start, America is a very litigious society, as we know. And so there's always lawyers waiting in the wings. And people who are public figures certainly have public relations advisors at hand who are trying to sort of fix something that's gone wrong, or they're trying to promote something that they see as good about whoever this is. And when there's been some sort of incident, the PR consultant is creating lots of noise to mask that out. In France, things, I think, are very different in that I think that these sort of situations play out with a kind of a wink and a nod in a way that women, like, for instance, French political figures, numerous French political figures have had transgressive relationships that in American terms would be the fodder of lots of pursuing journalists who would chase it down. In France, it's greeted with a shrug. Okay, so so-and-so has a mistress, or so-and-so is fooling around with a number of guys, you know. So it's seen as being, well, that's the human side of things, and we'll just leave that alone. And that's a sort of societal attitude that, I mean, I can't conceive of a lawsuit, for example. I don't think I've ever read one of a lawsuit of the kind that you would see here over issues like that happening in France. And so I think that it's greeted almost with – the things I've read about this seem to greet it with an almost sort of amused aside, that this is, you know, okay, this is a much more sophisticated attitude kind of thing, that's how people in France seem to see it.
Yeah, so the woman's name, by the way, is Blanche Gardin, and she's done things like appear at an award ceremony with a button wearing with a photo of Louis C.K. On it. I don't know, Teresa, we're right back where you started us. I mean, is that whole question of, you know, what's the punishment? How do you live out the punishment? When are you pardoned? And who gets to decide? And I mean, I think we would all agree Blanche Gardin ought to be free to make whatever choice she wants about Louis C.K.
I do. So of all of this, I find her choice to actually date Louis C.K. the most interesting of all, because a longtime listener of this show know that I was here yelling about Louis C.K. before he finally admitted to all his Me Too sins, and that I was then on the show when it finally, you know, hit the news. And so, but she sort of said very eloquently in this article about her the thing that I was trying to articulate and probably didn't do too well, which is that people love him for exploring the dark side of things and makes them feel better about their own dark side. But then when they found out he wasn't just joking all the time, they got surprised and now they're mad at him. And that's totally fine. The things he did were disgusting and he deserves some sort of punishment. But I also think, and then again, proportionality comes into this. And there's been a lot of hubbub over the last couple of months about Louis C.K. daring to show up and do, you know, stand-up spots at unannounced at the Comedy Cellar or wherever. And, you know, people get up and storm out because they didn't agree to see Louis C.K. And it's like, well, you didn't agree to see anyone who showed up here tonight. Mm-hmm. Like, that's too bad. But I think if anyone has the ability to come back from one of these scandals, it's Louis C.K., in part because if he just did a really great set about this whole thing, people would go back to forgiving him.
Which is the thing that he hasn't done so far.
Exactly.
Which a lot of comedians, we did have a conversation about this on the news pretty recently. Well, Bill, you're going to get the last word on this one.
Louis C.K. is a creepy little dude, and I kind of want Adonis Creed to punch him in the face. Mm-hmm. But having said that, don't fire me.
Yeah.
There are distinctions between his creepy behavior and like the rapey kind of things he did. Mm-hmm. But he's for what we know, he's not actually a rapist. I have really mixed feelings about the resurrection of Louis C.K. On the one hand, like, should a venue be allowed to like have him appear? Sure, I think they probably should. On the other hand, you know, Teresa said some people storm out, but other people welcome him as like some kind of like conquering hero.
Yeah, and I think he's
the voice of freedom. Yeah, and I think that's nonsense.
I agree, and I think that some of those people actually are turned on by that particular trait of his behavior.
Maybe literally.
And literally. And I think that that's part of the issue as well.
Yeah.
Well, we have to stop. We can't talk about Louis C.K. all day long, although, in fact, the parameters of this show could actually create that situation pretty easily, or maybe he could. Anyway, we have to take a break so we'll have time to talk about Creed 2. Is she really going out with him? Is she really gonna take him home tonight? Is she really going out with him? Because if my eyes don't deceive me, there's something going wrong around here. And we're back, and probably on a sturdier and safer terrain now, with Teresa Kramer, writer and editor at eContent Magazine, James Hanley, co-founder of Cine Studio at Trinity College, Bill Usman, a professor of media studies at Sacred Heart University. So, yes, we went to the movies. I have to have a confession to make. Like, I basically cry. I cried, like, really hard at Creed 1. and I cried at Creed 2, too. And I tend to cry at movies like this. But we went to see Creed 2, which is an extension of an extension. It's an extension of the first Creed movie, which starred Michael B. Jordan, was directed by Ryan Coogler, and is an extension of the Rocky series. If you haven't paid attention, it's the story – how can I do this? It's the story of the son of the character Apollo Creed, who is played by Carl Weathers, who is kind of discovered, wants to be a boxer despite the fact that his dad died in the ring, and so winds up with his dad's frenemy, Rocky Balboa, as his trainer. And so here we are with the second movie. Michael B. Jordan plays Adonis, who is the son of Apollo Creed, and Tessa Thompson plays his beloved, Bianca. They're talking about a situation where, I don't know, we don't want to give too much away, but things haven't gone too well in one of Adonis's fights, and he's thinking maybe he still has to fight again.
Why do it again? What do you have to prove?
It's not about that. You wouldn't be any good to anybody if you didn't do what you love. You wouldn't be able to breathe, right? Well, I wouldn't be any good to anybody if I don't handle this the right way. But I need you. I'll beat him.
So, Teresa, we actually do know that it's possible to make a really bad movie with Michael B. Jordan in it running around doing physical stuff. That would be the Fantastic Four. But it's yeah. It's hard to make a bad movie with Michael B. Jordan kind of doing what Michael B. Jordan can do anyway. I mean, he really is one of the most exciting and gifted actors of his fairly young generation at this point. So, and I know you're a big fan. So how did this work for you?
Yeah, I mean, if you're incapable of being objective about David Edelstein, I'm incapable of being objective about Michael B. Jordan. I liked this movie quite a bit. I liked Creed 1 a lot as well. And I've been thinking a lot about why I like sports movies but don't really like sports. And a part of it is, you know, the sheer drama of it. Everything is more exciting when there's a whole storyline and you get to be right in the middle of the action. But I'm verklempt over here about Michael B. Jordan.
Don't treat him as a sexual object, though, because that demeans him, okay?
I know. But, I mean, he is – someone in our email threads said that he is both vulnerable and menacing at the same time, I think. And he does – he has this perfect ability about him while still being able to beat a giant Russian man to a pulp, you know? If you go into this movie thinking Creed doesn't win something, so you don't understand sports movies.
What? All right. So, I don't know about that. Well, anyway, so James, I'm not even sure I know from all our emails what James's total overall take on this was.
Well, I really like Michael B. Jordan as well. I think that he's a gifted actor. That's a very good description of him. But I can't say that this movie really I mean, he and Tessa Thompson have a kind of chemistry on screen, and that's interesting, but that's totally sort of a backstory, obviously, to what's going on. And I found the rest of the movie kind of like had a lot of sort of stereotypical stuff, of course, and not a particularly earth-shaking plot, really. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get out of my mind that the opponent in the ring, he was listed in the cast as Big Nasty in the middle of his name.
Right.
And I thought, you know, okay, well, all right. And he, I don't think he cracked a smile once in the
I don't
movie.
Believe he's an actor. He's
a real boxer from
yeah.
He's
Romania.
He's a boxer who's acting as opposed to an actor who's boxing.
That's right. But the thing to me is what I really wish is that somebody with Jordan's talents, why isn't he getting better parts than that? I mean, I think that this is a commercial part and he's going to make good money from it and good luck to him. But I found myself thinking, wow, he could really do something he could really do something with his career other than playing something like this.
I think I have the answer to that, which is that in a recent profile I read about him is that his goal is to basically be a matinee idol. He wants to be a movie star, full stop, which means he's got to be in like the Bourne series or something. You know,
right.
He needs a series like
that. I think we actually found our next James Bond.
So before Bill goes, let me just say I should probably have said a little bit more about this. It involves going through the sort of almost Greek mythology of, or maybe Italian mythology of Rocky. So what you need to know is that in Rocky IV, Apollo Creed, the character played by Carl Weathers, this will be a spoiler if you haven't seen Rocky IV, but that's not my problem. He does fight a Russian boxer. Way back there in Rocky IV, he fights a Russian boxer named Ivan Drago, who kills in the ring Apollo Creed in a way that is a little bit Rocky's fault. He doesn't throw in the towel soon enough. He's the trainer of his friend Apollo Creed. And by the way, we're doing a show on towels next week. The producer of the show, the producer of that one, he wants you to know that. Anyway, then Rocky has to go to Russia and train and essentially revenge the death of his friend in this ring. So this is a continuation of that story. Dolph Lundgren, who played this character way back in Rocky IV, now plays the father of the unsmiling Victor Drago, who is now going to basically, you know, have a similar kind of encounter with the son of Apollo Creed. There, Bill, I think I did it.
Great. Yeah. So we're done. See you next week, folks. I'll do a little bit of Teresa and a little bit of James and then throw in some Bill at the end. I totally am on board with Teresa about like really just like what a wonderful actor Michael B. Jordan is, and I really have loved almost everything he's done, barring Fantastic Four. Sorry, but I am on board with James in terms of I don't think this is a really very good movie. I don't think it's a really necessary movie. I found it ridiculously predictable and hackneyed and trite and plodding. It's a bad sign when I'm kind of waiting for the resolution that I know is coming just so that the movie can be over. And that is how I felt. And I know I'm being like really harsh about it. I was not a big fan of the Rocky mythos, and I see racial politics and gender politics in everything, as people who have listened to the show before know. And I thought the racial politics and the gender politics of the Rocky films were very, very troubling. But I was interested in Creed 1 because of the way that it upended that. And the way it really did kind of shift the lens and shift the focus, putting the emphasis on Adonis Creed, played by Michael B. Jordan, really tilted that for me in some very interesting ways. And I did like it, and I thought it was a very good movie. Creed 2 just feels unnecessary to me, and I don't see it doing anything particularly original or interesting. And so I know I'm being like a really harsh critic of it, but it just did leave me kind of cold.
Let me just say a few quick things about it. First of all, yeah, it's directed by a different director. Ryan Coogler is a terrific director.
Yes, he is.
And he directed Creed 1. He also directed Black Panther. I actually think Creed 1's a better movie than Black Panther, but that's another conversation. I do think with this one, he doesn't this younger, newer director, whose name is Stephen Caple Jr., doesn't seem to get quite the same – doesn't have that same gift of, first of all, getting that quality out of Michael Jordan that you're talking mm-hmm. about. I didn't see it quite as often, that real combination of menace and vulnerability. When I saw it, it felt a little overdrawn and a little bit forced out. There's a bunch of other interesting characters in this movie who never get developed. Brigitte Nielsen is back in several different respects in this movie, but she is used almost entirely as a prop. She was mm-hmm. the wife mm-hmm. of Ivan Drago. The wonderful actor who played Avon Barksdale on The Wire is back, but is in this movie kind of as the first trainer. I do want to say a couple of things about Sylvester Stallone. He has gravitated into the kinds of roles that were played by Burgess Meredith and Burt Young in those Rocky movies. He's a little bit the comic relief, a little bit the voice of elder wisdom. You know, he's actually pretty good. I mean, he got an Oscar nomination for the first one. Whether that was merited, we could debate. But he's actually pretty good at that. And as Jonathan McPants pointed out, Dolph Lundgren is actually pretty good in this movie.
I honestly could not disagree more on that front. Okay. Like, I think I don't have high expectations for a sports movie. So when the first Creed came along, I was like, wow, this is amazing. It exceeded all expectations. And then when the second one comes along and it's just good, that's fine by me because it's a sports movie. I don't mm-hmm. need it to do very much. But Dolph Lundgren, in the scene where he comes into Rocky's restaurant, I could not have thought anything was more overacted than – I mean, and Brigitte Nielsen is like – I was like, are they just – they don't want to pay her like something or they don't want her to get SAG card again?
Well, it turns out she was 54 years old and very pregnant during the shooting.
So she couldn't speak?
Or I don't know. Yeah. I mean,
speaking would have cost extra.
I honestly think they don't want to have to give her a SAG card or something.
Right.
And
it
so
like
they
that,
didn't
yeah.
let her speak. I don't
it
know
was,
what's going
that
on.
That was really strange, I thought. She just is standing there. Okay.
Well, I actually thought – and I said this in our emails – that – all of the Russians to me actually looked like almost like science fiction robot villains to me.
Yeah. The one thing that I would say about this that's kind of serious is I'm the person here who's hung around boxing in mm-hmm. real life a bit, and it's not a particularly nice place most of the time. But it's a very interesting place all the time, and it's a pretty interesting place without having these kind of supervillain type scenarios where so much is on the line. But starting with Rocky III, where Mr. T was introduced as Clubber Lang, and then on to Ivan Drago, and now in this movie, you have these kinds of almost superhero stakes, mm-hmm. you know, where somebody's maybe probably going to die, or it's just so bad, it's so scary. It can't just be boxing, you know. Mm-hmm. It's more than that. And there's now I think there's almost no headroom under the ceiling. I mean, they just have gone so far out with the kind of extreme stakes. I don't know where they maneuver after that. So I think our recommendation is maybe watch the first Creed if you've never seen it.
Oh, definitely, yes. But first Creed, really interesting.
And then you can just decide whether you need to see another one.
All right. Watch Friday Night Lights.
And watch Friday Night
My
Lights.
My wife's favorite TV show.
The last two seasons, especially for your Michael B. Jordan
right.
fix. Yeah.
Vince.
Yes.
All right. And watch The Wire, too. All right. So speaking of recommendations, we'll make some after this.
When does it end? Are we going to see a bunch of movies 20 years from now where Natasha Drago fights poor little Amara Creed? No, wait. Marty Drago, Victor's kid, gets Amara pregnant, and then they have a kid who fights the grandson of Mr. T's character, Clubber Lang. Can't we all just get along? Today's show is produced by Apollo McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Amanda Fish will fight a pet tuna belonging to Marvin Hagler in the Vatican in 2019. The part of Bill Curry was played by Burt Young. On Monday's show, does Donald Trump appeal to insecure men? And now, back to Colin.
Yes. I mean, by the way, yes. but it's time to make some recommendations here. Let's see what Teresa Kramer has for us.
I'm recommending a series from Radiolab called In the Know. It was a 3-series podcast. You can get it in the regular Radiolab feed, but it sort of explores gender relations and the Me Too era from multiple sides, including ones you probably wouldn't expect, and I thought was really, really interesting and did a much better job of sort of injecting humanity and just, you know, human error back into this conversation and really exploring it from all sides.
Oh, mm-hmm. Good recommendation. All right, James, what have you got for us?
Well, I just want to celebrate Willimantic, which is my favorite place to go on Main Street, particularly businesses like Cafe Mantic. There's a wonderful, incredible menu there. And the Fish Market, who...
Oh, I know those people. They're great.
They are amazing. They have such an incredible variety of fish available. Very fresh, delightful place to go. And there's also Not Only Juice, which is a wonderful sort of quick restaurant that's really good. And You're Making Me Crazy. It's really a wonderful place to go. So I really celebrate that.
The fish people, he's a Giants fan and she's a Patriots fan.
That's correct. The kind yes.
of, oh, you actually knew that?
Yes. They've told me this.
All right, okay. Something I've talked to them a lot. All right. So, Bill Usman, what have you got for us?
So, as part of the theme of artists that we lost in 2018, Dolores O'Riordan was the lead singer of the Cranberries. Mm-hmm. And she died under some really sad and tragic circumstances earlier in the year. Everybody knows about the Cranberries, rightfully so. But I just want to endorse, they've recently put out the 25th anniversary release of their first album, Everybody Else Is Doing It, So Why Can't We? And it's dedicated to the memory of Dolores O'Riordan. The original album, I think, is pretty close to being a perfect album. I just love this so much in so many ways. Warm, emotional, full-throated kind of rock music. And on the new release, the 25th anniversary version, there's all kinds of extras, including their original debut EP and some rough versions of the songs. And it's really, really great.
So what's the new compilation is called?
It's the same name as the debut. Okay. Everybody Else Is Doing It, So Why Can't We? It's the 25th anniversary edition.
Well, cool. So I'm going to quickly endorse a not particularly expensive restaurant in Farmington, Connecticut, right next to Highland Park. It's called Mengetsu. It's sort of Japanese and Korean. I think it's more Korean than Japanese. And they've kind of taken a not particularly interesting space and made it really interesting. My son and I were there last night. We had really good food. We're the only people in the restaurant, which is one of the reasons I'm endorsing it. But I think they are getting crowds there and stuff. And it's really – it's a nice place and they seem like nice people. And there's kind of an open kitchen there. And it's so Mengetsu in Farmington, right next to Highland Park and the post office. And I thought maybe also I've got some other endorsements that I could do, but it might be fun just in the last couple of minutes – particularly since we have James here, we not only lost Bertolucci, but almost the same day, I think Nicholas Roeg also died. So, first of all, James, I don't know, is there a Bertolucci movie you would really recommend that people go see? I mean, I'll ask the other panelists too. But,
well, there are two. One, the very long, complete version of 1900. And also
the 6-hour one or the 4-hour one?
The
6-hour one. You get it. Okay.
Yeah, which we have shown at Cine Studio actually on two consecutive nights, I believe.
Don't drink coffee
before you go see it.
Right. And then also The Last Emperor, which I think was an extraordinary film, not only well made, but it also he managed to get access to places in the Forbidden City, which had not been on film before. But it's an extraordinary work of art and is an illustration of what an incredibly talented filmmaker he was. So I would pick those two films.
Anybody else want to shout out any of these?
Oh, I would just throw out The Conformist just because Italy under Mussolini and its relevance for today's times.
It's in a future episode, I want to have the panel discuss My Brilliant Friend, which is the new HBO adaptation of Elena Ferrante, which is sort of post-World War II Italy. There's a way in which it kind of continues some of those themes maybe. I'm also thinking about Nicholas Roeg. I happen to be a big fan. I think if you haven't seen the movie Don't Look Now, you have to see it almost immediately. I mean, it really is an essential movie in a bunch of different ways. Although there's a love scene there that, who knows, maybe it's really controversial and didn't ever look that way to me. But although it's a pretty amazing love scene. And Walkabout also, which is a terrific early movie with Jenny Agutter sort of lost in the Australian outback and getting help from an Aboriginal source. I don't know. Anybody want to do a Nicholas Roeg one too?
The very, very – I think very, very strange, The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say The Man Who Fell to Earth. But I think one of my most enduring favorites of his is Walkabout, definitely. It's an extraordinary film and far ahead of its time.
And a great novel.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
That it was based on.
Yeah. Right.
We have like two or three more seconds, so Teresa and I will endorse the town of Montpelier, Vermont.
Yes.
I go up to Montreal whenever I get a chance, and you're always sort of wondering, where do I pull off the highway to maybe get a little lunch, go to the bathroom, get some gas, whatever. And boy, Montpelier is a nice little town, isn't it?
It's a lovely size. Like it's, you know, not so tiny like Brattleboro, but not as huge as Burlington. It's like the perfect little Vermont size to actually see some stuff while you're...
And there's a good vibe somehow. Yeah. There's a nice vibe. The people seem to be happy and creative and proud of their downtown and stuff like that. So Montpelier, Vermont. All right. We have to stop there other than to mention that another death from this week was the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants. His name is Steven Hillenburg. Died young, 57, from ALS, a terrible disease. But let's end with a little SpongeBob.
Oh, who lives in a pineapple under the sea? Nonsense be something you wish.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Then drop on the deck and flop like a fish.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Ready? SpongeBob SquarePants. SpongeBob SquarePants. SpongeBob SquarePants. SpongeBob SquarePants.